Here's the water. Okay. Well, what I did in this book, The Face of Imperialism, which, by the way, is a quote from W.H. Auden, who talks about imperialism's face in a world of ugliness and such. What I wanted to do is get people to kind of understand what empire is. In 1995, I wrote a book called Against Empire, and it was about America and what the U.S. was doing around much of the world. And I had people say to me, empire? Oh, come on, Parenti, there you go, over the top again, you're writing about U.S. foreign policy, and most American schools, political science departments, you can't get a course on U.S. empire. There'll be U.S. foreign policy and its place in the world today, you know, something really sweet and simple and pure and all sort of thing. So they say empire, and it was true. Back in 95, you didn't use the word empire. In fact, when I was a kid, I remember teachers saying, America doesn't have an empire. We do not have colonies. We have possessions. We have territories. We don't have colonies. And we don't have empire. But when I wrote my book, another book I wrote later on called The Assassination of Julius Caesar, which was about ancient Rome, I started going through the classical literature on the Roman Empire and other empires too. And you know, it's an odd thing, but empire is treated very positively, sort of, by these neutral, objective scholars. Empire is seen as kind of a force of cleaning up, of dominion that brings order where there was a lot of violent, squabbly tribes and all that. Empire brings peace. We even have the term Pax Romana, the Roman peace. You know how much peace there was in Rome during that Pax Romana? About as much peace as in Afghanistan, you guys say. And we had Pax Britannica, remember? Britain ruled Britannia, and we bring peace. So that's what empire is seen as, a really nice, good thing. And the movies you see, right? Remember all those movies, those gladiator movies? Come on, confess it. You've seen a few of them at least, you know, where the senators over there, Rome, and Rome shall this, and Rome. And you're sitting and you go, oh, Rome, yes, Rome. And, wait a minute, I got nothing with Rome, you know? So there was this kind of positive feeling about empire. Well, the empire we have is an empire without colonies in the U.S. It's an empire, and that's why we call it neo-colonial and neo-imperialist. And what I started noticing, by the year 2000, a whole host of books started coming out in the States using the title empire in their title. I'm using the word empire in their title. Follies of Empire, Twilight of Empire, The Challenge of Empire, all of them referring to the United States Empire. Suddenly, people were admitting that we had an empire. You'd even see conservative pundits on the air saying, we're an empire, and we better act like an empire, and fulfill our responsibilities and all that, as if the power of this country gave it an entitlement to go into other lands and destroy them, or redirect them, or do it whatever they want to them. So this was a remarkable thing, and I said, now how is it that these liberals and conservatives will use the word empire for America? And then I realized why they did. They talked about empire, but they never talked about imperialism. They never talked about imperialism. Now, imperialism is what empires do, you see. And instead of that, they diluted the concept, and they thought of empire, and even imperialism, if they ever used the term, it was a matter of dominion. It just meant that our power was extended. Chalmers Johnson talks that way. We're an empire of military bases all over the world, you know, and we're controlling, and that's it. Now, that's not what empire is about. Empire is really about something else. Empire is about a thing called capitalism. Today's empires are. It's more than just bases. There's 700 U.S. military bases, maybe more, depending on how you count what's a base or not a base, all around the world. No other country in the world feels the necessity to have all these bases everywhere. But these bases are there to protect a process, a global process, a global network of military and security forces, paramilitary forces, police, special security police, and death squads, or in countries across the globe, all financed, equipped, advised, and trained by the U.S. Pentagon and the CIA and related agencies. In Africa, for instance, 50 nations have received extensive military aid from the U.S. at one time or another, not all at the same time. But 50 nations in Africa have received aid from the U.S. There are only 53 countries in Africa. And so you can see that the U.S. has been very busy doing all this together. And what they were doing was extending the power of that empire, but that wasn't all they were doing. It wasn't power for power's sake. The power is an instrument of empire, not the end all. It's not an end in itself. It is the instrument. The goal of empire and the goal of imperialism is to expropriate the wealth of the world. The subsidiary goal is to make that world safe for the expropriators. Give them a secure hand in doing things. So that's what imperialism is. It's when the plutocratic class of one country extorts and expropriates the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets of another country. And that's what the game is all about. There is a material, political, economic content to imperialism. And that's what it's worth. And the summary effect of that is not to spread prosperity, as they claim, but it spreads poverty. Poverty and wealth are often seen as being an unfortunate juxtaposition. Oh, look, so much wealth here, so much poverty here. If only they would give a little to them. Oh, isn't that just terrible? You should really say more accurately that there's a dynamic link between that wealth and that poverty. The poorer I can keep you, the harder you work for less and less, the more there is for me. The less claim you can make on this world, the more claim I can make. These rulers, these corporate plutocratic rulers, do not want a public. They do not want a public that is educated, articulate, able to organize, has a sense of its own entitlements, has a high level of expectation for themselves and their children. They don't want that. They want people who are desperate, disorganized, living from hand to mouth, and ready to put their nose to the grindstone without causing any trouble. So, in case I haven't depressed you enough yet already, this whole myth that capitalism brings prosperity, and I'm arguing that capitalism brings poverty, and I want to demonstrate the contrary. All our lives we heard about capitalism and prosperity, the corporations. Where would we be were it not for the corporations, the job creators? That's the term they're using now. The job creators. A neighbor of mine said this recently. He said, hey, Parenti, we were standing in a cafe right around the corner from my house in Berkeley, and he's saying, You know, the corporations are job creators. And just that day, maybe he hadn't seen the paper, I said, like Bank of America, which just laid off 30,000 people the last 2 days. He said, well, you know, sometimes. Now, here's the formula I'll give you. I want to demonstrate the contrary view from that lifelong one that you got about capitalism creating prosperity. I will demonstrate the contrary if you give me just 15 seconds, okay? One, most of the world is capitalist and most of the world is poor. In those parts of the world where capitalist, two, in those parts of the world where capitalist investment has little or no regulation imposed on it, the populations are poorest, the investors enjoy the highest rate of return. The more free trade and free market the world becomes, the poorer it has become. So the more capitalist it becomes, the poorer. Consider capitalist Indonesia, capitalist Guatemala, capitalist Mexico, capitalist Nigeria. These countries are all very poor, and they get, what is that called? What's the term now? I forgot. Resource, is it, what?
Resource-based?
Resource.
Allocation?
It's about a resource victimization, how you victimize if you've got resources.
Depletion.
Yeah, no, but see, this is called preparation. I should have done my homework. I know. But the Native American Indians, Native Americans in the U.S., the First Nation people, I guess they call sometimes in Canada, they used to say, if you find oil on your reservation, stamp it down, bury it over, put a pile of sand on it, because if you got oil on your reservation, you lose your reservation. You're going to be driven out. All sorts of people are going to come in and discover new deeds that they had all along. This land really belonged to them, you know.
Confiscate the wealth of the people.
Resource curse. Who said that? All right. You win the toaster. Okay. Oh, I love quiz games. All right. Well, how do we know I'm arguing as follows. I'm arguing that recession, which is an impoverishment of the populace, is not such a bad thing for everyone. It's a bad thing for the 99%, but it's not a bad thing for the 1% at all. Recessions, all sorts of things happen. During recessions, you have small competitors are bought up for bargain prices. Small businesses are wiped out by big businesses. Big capital squeezes out small capital. Labor unions are tamed and even broken, and sometimes it becomes harder to organize. It's hard to organize when people just worried about hanging on to a job, that if they talk to a union organizer, they're going to lose that job and the like. Labor itself, not the union, but the human labor power itself is tamed. You work harder for less pay and doing work under conditions that you had not imagined you would be doing. So this recession we have in the U.S. is a jobless recovery. Massive hardships along with record profits. That's what's going on right now. Recessions also advance privatization. As state and local communities are going deeper into debt, facing more acute budget crises, they try to meet, in short-term solutions, they try to meet their expenses by selling off public property. They'll sell off parklands for private developers. They'll sell off bridges. The Bay Bridge, the East Bay Bridge that connects Berkeley and Oakland to San Francisco, belongs to a Spanish consortium. And it was sold off for hundreds of millions of dollars, and they collect the tolls on it now. And I think there's all sorts of rigmaroles, who's responsible for repairs and retrofitting and all that. I don't know all the details. But that's the way they're getting money. They're selling off utilities, bridges, prisons, schools, and the like. And they close other services. The city of Oakland, you've heard of Oakland, California? They specialize in beating up and killing demonstrators, right? Well, but you look at those Oakland cops the day of that attack on the demonstrators, and they have on their person, each one of them must have like $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 worth of equipment. They've got bulletproof vests. They've got Darth Vader helmets with the shields. They've got tasers. They've got sprays. They've got mace sprays. They've got percussion grenades, which the, remember the when the people crowded around Scott Olsen, who had been hit in the head by a tear gas canister, and he was lying there bleeding. They huddled around. I saw it right on the internet. There was this cop just standing just far away from there, and he pulled that percussion grenade, pulled it, and tossed it in right on all these people. It could bust your eardrums open. Now, what is a policeman in a civil society doing? What the hell is he doing with a percussion grenade? What is this about? What are they doing with automatic weapons and combat boots and all this other stuff that they've got? So money is no object, because that's a federal program. That isn't even Oakland buying those things for them, although Oakland has to chip in some of it. But every city in the United States, you'll find these Darth Vader combat guys. This is a police force that can't come when you've got a crime. They even announced that they're not going to bother with any crimes that don't involve violence against person. So if you're mugged and your wallet is stolen from you, they can't be bothered with that. It interrupts their donut. It interrupts their donut and coffee time, you know. So here they are. In that city of Oakland, which can afford, or can almost afford the police force, in that city, they just closed 14 of their 18 libraries. And what does that do for kids? I remember when I was a kid, I was born and raised in Italian Harlem, it was called in those days. It's now Latin American, most of it. But in Manhattan. Manhattan is the center of New York City. And it was a working class, low income place. But I remember the library was a real refuge to me in my life. When I got tired of hanging out at the pool room and the handball court and on the street, I would go to the library and I would read books, and I would look in these books. And I had no great intellectuality at all, but I saw, like, you'd get glimpses at windows into other worlds and other places. A library was like a refuge, you know. And if anything, there are kids in Oakland who definitely, a library is about the only quiet place they can find. These are all going to be closed. They're going to be closed because they cannot. They're too expensive. This country, richest country in the world, they keep bragging about it, and they can't even open up a little library branch, some of which are about a half the size of this room themselves. Now, how do I know why the U.S. intervenes everywhere, invades and attacks countries, embargoes them, sanctions them? How do I know that's being done for imperialism? How do I know it isn't done for the reasons they say, for humanitarian wars, with killing and destroying these people for humanitarian wars? Thank you, Jim. And I think it's very simple. It's a very consistent and very conscious policy. Any country that tries to get out of this global network, that tries to use its land, labor, natural resources, markets, and capital for its own development, even in a capitalist way, but for itself, not as part of this global corporate empire, any country that does that is attacked or targeted. And it doesn't mean the country has to be socialist or communist or anything like that. Any country that does that. All through, the U.S. rulers have attacked countries, many countries in Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, Far East, Central Asia. But only those that have attempted reformist or revolutionary governments, or only those that have tried some kind of self-developing and self-defining path. Those are the countries that attack. I rest my case. I mean, it's so consistent. And every country that's ruled by a ruler, whether he's democratically elected or dictator, and that's true of the other ones, whether they're democratically elected, like Allende, like Milosevic in Yugoslavia, like Aristide in Haiti, or dictator like Mohammed Gaddafi in Libya, it doesn't matter what they are. If they take this other independent course, and if they try to get out from the reach and stretch of the global Fortune 500, they will be targeted or put in the crosshairs. Right now in the crosshairs, we see Iran is right there, you see. Now Iran is not a leftist, liberal, progressive country, but it's doing things in a different way, an alternative way. And it is eventually to be attacked. I think it's just a matter of time. And meanwhile, those countries that do support and do open up their country to Western capital and say, come on in, boys, it's all yours, come on, whatever you want, just give me my little share and give my brother Jose his share, you know, or my brother Abdul, depends on what part of the world you're in, so just take care of this one, and the rest is all yours. The people get out of line, well, my security police, who you've trained, equipped, and advised, they'll crack their heads and all that sort of thing. They try to unionize, we'll crack them real hard, and it's all yours. So it's very consistent. That is the variable. I'll give you an example of two leaders like that. Gaddafi, who did things like kick the oil companies out, use the oil revenues to build schools, hospitals, housing, education, all sorts, use the revenue to build, take these aquifer from the southern Libya, you know, and bring it up with all this water, for pure, beautiful water for the people of Libya, most of whom lived in the north, to drink and for farming and all that stuff, without the IMF, having no need, refusing to take in the IMF, he's targeted. He's a dictator. Dictator number two, right next door to him, a guy by the name of Mubarak. For 30 years, Mubarak ruled Egypt. And for 30 years, I never heard him referred to once as a dictator. He was always called President Mubarak. And during the uprisings, where was President Obama on President Mubarak? I'll tell you where he was. He was right by his side. He and Hillary were saying, oh, give the man a chance. Oh, what now? Come on now. Let's make sure this is responsible. But it was up to the point where they could no longer support him because nobody supported Mubarak anymore. So they had to jettison him. The way Reagan had to get rid of Marcos in the Philippines. He's no longer useful. He's become such a catalyst for protest and rage that it's better we get a whole set of new faces, make a few little cosmetic changes until the revolution loses its steam and we keep control of the means of production and the resources of the country. So there it is. Oh, but there are different variables. You're talking about two different men. Okay, let me give you that same example I just gave you, and let's do it with one man, okay? His name is Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein came to power through the CIA in Iraq. His first gig for the CIA was an assassination of the democratically elected prime minister of Iraq, who presided over a broad-based coalition government. A government that had had a revolution, that had kicked out the British and American oil companies, and was trying to develop reform. So, you know, when the U.S. propagandists say, we're going into Iraq to teach these poor little backward Iraqis about democracy, they overlook the fact that 45, 50 years ago, they had democracy. They already were putting it together. Well, 40 some years ago. His first, he shot the prime minister, didn't kill him, but wounded him seriously, and the CIA ushered him away to some, safe house somewhere. Later on, with guns, with death squads, with groups, he took over the Ba'athist Party, and he killed every, in Iraq, he went ahead and he overthrew that government, and he killed every constitutionalist, every Democrat, every communist, every socialist, every reformist, or either kill them or force them into exile or underground. And he even liquidated the whole left wing of his own Ba'athist Party. And when he did all that, when he was at his most murderous and torturing people in unforgiving ways, unbelievable things that he did. He was Washington's poster boy. They loved him. They'd get their pictures taken with Saddam Hussein. They'd go visit him and say, oh, you brought order here and you're keeping things real nice and all that. They couldn't do enough in giving him aid and the like. Then he started getting out of line. Now we go to the next leader, whose name is Saddam Hussein. And he starts doing things like demanding more on the oil quotas at a time when they wanted to cut down marketing of oil because George Herbert Walker Bush, the father of this Bush, was president at the time, was concerned that oil prices would collapse and Saddam Hussein was cut out of much of the market, and he himself said, there are many forms of aggression against a nation. I see now this is another form. This is disastrous for Iraq. He got out of line on that. He got out of line on the economy. He kept a state-owned economy. Rather than privatizing, he kept it as nationalized. In other words, it was a socialist kind of economy, and he kept a lot of the programs. Well, he became what? Saddam Hussein, worse than Hitler. Saddam Hussein, the man who might destroy us all if we don't stop him now, and the like. So, I mean, it is so consistent, again and again and again. Noriega, Milosevic, Hussein, Gaddafi, all of you demonize the leader, you demonize the leader for his movement or whatever, and that gives you license then to bomb his people and bomb the country and destroy his utilities and destroy his power plants and factories and farms and schools and whatever else. I saw the bombing in Yugoslavia, 78 days by William Jefferson Clinton, President Clinton of the United States, 78 days of bombing in Yugoslavia. I can tell you, it was not a happy experience. In fact, in the book, The Face of Imperialism, I have a little section on Yugoslavia. I call it Privatization by Bombing. Okay. Just talk among yourselves while I catch up with my notes here.
Weren't you mixing the Shah and Saddam Hussein a little bit when you talked about
No, I was talking about Saddam. This is after the Shah. So Saddam Hussein came along after the Shah had been taken in. Now, one of the things you often hear, again and again, you see it in print, you can see it in conferences and all that. The question comes up, why? I remember hearing this at a Michael Harrington conference in New York, somebody in the audience saying, Mr. Harrington, why is American foreign policy so stupid? I know people around laughing. And I got up and I said, you know, I don't think it's stupid. I think it's incredibly successful. It has stopped social revolution all through Central America, all through Latin America, all through Asia, all with one or two exceptions, and all through Africa. I think it's not stupid at all, and it's very directed and selective. You know, some of the things I said now, very briefly, because I was just somebody in the audience. But that is again and again what we hear, that U.S. policy is inept, it's reckless. These are some of the adjectives I gathered from the literature, and I have that in the book there, but here's a few of them. Inept, reckless, misguided, overreaching, arrogant, deluded, aggrandizing, miscalculating, blah, blah. Richard Cohen. Richard Cohen is a columnist for the Washington Post. You want to know how you can become a columnist for the Washington Post? You got to learn to write sentences like this. This is what he said. The Iraq War is not the product of oil avarice or CIA evil. Never said that was the only two things involved. But of a surfeit of altruism. It's the product of a naive compulsion to do good. I'm saying, Richard Cohen, that's how you get to be the columnist, to write these improbable sentences like that. And he cites, who does he cite as the compulsive do-gooders? who suffer from a surfeit of altruism. He cites George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and these are the do-gooders, you see. Washington Post, December 2005. Okay. How did the empire builders get the American people to go along with this? Well, the most effective way is by fear. There are appeals made to messianic mission, task or voyage or destiny in the world, which is to help the world, blah, blah, and this and that. Americans, that doesn't really sell all that well, all that much, you know. What really gets them is fear. When you say that we are beset, we are surrounded by enemies, by political demons from abroad. And, you know, for about 40, 50, what, how many years? A century maybe, we heard it about communism. Communism, the communists are everywhere. The communists are in our schools. The communists are in Hollywood. The communists are in the professions. The communists are in the labor unions. The communists gonna get you. Communists under your bed. Communists gonna get your mama. They're gonna get your mama, watch out.
McCarthy years.
And then, even after and before the McCarthy years, if you were in the party, you lost your teaching job, you lost this, you lost that. All sorts of things happened to you. Even if you were just in organizations that had been listed in the Attorney General's list as, quote, subversive, you know, like the National Lawyers Guild was called one that was, it was on some list of theirs, you know. This made up of progressive lawyers. A lot of them were not even in the party or anything like that. Well, after the Soviet Union was overthrown and the Eastern European communist countries were overthrown and the capitalist paradise was restored in those countries. By the way, you know, there was a poll just a few years ago, a survey, I shouldn't say poll, it was a very systematic survey conducted by, of all people, Richard Pipes, you know, the Cold War Mandarin from Harvard. I will give him credit. He didn't suppress the findings. He published them. I'll give the guy credit for that. But he was aghast when he saw a poll of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union about conditions and life and all that, and a very substantial plurality, in some cases a majority, would say it was better under the communists. I mean, this must have, you know, it must have got his britches in a knot, you know? You don't use that term, do you? That's a British term. I like it. I always looking for
knickers in a twist.
Always looking for an opportunity to use it. It's knickers in a twist, right? That's what it is, not britches in a knot. Well, britches in a knot, you really hurt. Don't get your knickers in a twist, that's it. Well, he did, and that's what we got today. And there was this drastic time in the mid-90s when there was no Soviet Union, no inevitable communist threat, because that was the assumption people were saying in the US, why do we have all these bases all over the world? Why are we everywhere all the time? And the answer was, we have to always probe back as they probe at us. We have to contain this Soviet empire. We have to do what we can. Well, now the Soviet empire was gone. Here's, it's like running an experiment. Let's test that hypothesis. Remove the Soviet Union from the picture. And what happened? Well, the U.S. defense budget grew at an even greater rate. They built more bases. They now have bases in Kyrgyzstan, in Central Asia, massive bases. They never dreamed they could ever have a base there. That used to be Soviet territory. They have a massive major base in Kosovo, right in East Central Europe there, one of the biggest in the world. So, so what does this mean? And what does it mean then? It means that this global empire you were building was not a defensive thing against Soviet encroachment. It's an empire that you're building for having a global empire. And it's going on even after the Soviets are gone from the scene. If anything, since the overthrow of the Soviet Union, U.S. policymakers and imperialists have become more unbridled, more violent. They invaded Panama, they've invaded Haiti, they invaded Somalia. And what about Haiti rescue? What about the humanitarian rescue of Haiti last year? You remember the earthquake, the shattering earthquake? All sorts of countries brought aid. What did President Obama send to Haiti? He sent 15,000 Marines. That's what he sent. That's what he sent. The Cubans sent doctors and medical supplies, and Obama sent Marines. If that isn't the work of an imperialist, I don't know what. Invading Somalia, destroying Yugoslavia, invading Afghanistan, invading and occupying Iraq, destroying Libya, and right now today the U.S. has troops actively or indirectly or on the QT advised in military actions in about 5 or 6 other countries, or attacking them from the air. All of that since the Soviet Union. Now, there's no communist country in the world. There's no mad, mean dictator in the world that has a record of destruction and the like as this country, unfortunately. And with Libya, as with Yugoslavia, some people on the left who call themselves progressives, in those two cases, they would have to answer why. They stand shoulder to shoulder with NATO and the CIA and the Pentagon and support those wars, both of those wars. I think they're fighting the ghosts of Stalin or whatever it might be, but you have to ask them, not me. Those same people who say, don't trust the corporate media, they're full of distortions, they do trust the corporate media on Yugoslavia and Libya. Now the empire, and I have just a couple more points and I'm going to stop. The empire sees only two types of states beyond its borders. Either there's vassal states, that is satellites, or what we sometimes call client states. Or if you're not a satellite, if you're not in my orbit, if you're not subsuming your own judgments to me, or agreeing with me in some way, if you're not this, then you are that other type of state, an enemy or a potential enemy. There's some who you can't quite call an enemy. Obama got up at a state of...
Rogue
state. Obama got up at the State of the Union the year before last, and he talked about, he used another word, he said competitor. China is our competitor. He said China is competing. And I'm saying, China isn't my competitor. I got no competition going with China. I got nothing to prove as an individual or as a nation or a member of a nation that we have to do something with China. And the problem with China is it's about the only country in the world that isn't afraid of the United States. You know? It says, what do you got? 300 million people? We got 1.2 billion. Oh, what do you got? You got nuclear weapons? Oh, we got nuclear weapons too. Yeah, we got a whole arsenal. So you hit us, we'll hit you right back, and they'll be flying before yours land here. And another thing we got is what we have in China. We have a small army. We don't have a single soldier on soil elsewhere. We don't have any military bases around the world. Not officially and openly. When the Chinese, they're still involved. The Chinese and the who else was it? China, Taiwan, Philippines, and Vietnam. They're all sort of getting into a mix, a dust up about the oil reserves in the China Sea. Remember, the U.S. came in and said, "We will present our good offices and help mediate this dispute." China said, "Who the hell asked you? Come on, beat it. You have no historic claim and presence in this area. What do you want?" And so they didn't come. You know, the Americans were like indignant. They got their britches in a twist.
Nickered.
Well, what we have to do is get rid of this imperial mentality, and that's one of the things we've got to be struggling for. The empire, as you know by now, as you should deduce from what I've been saying, the empire feeds off the republic. Empires are very costly affairs, and the empire is rich, it's global, it's powerful, it's stronger than ever, as I said, these bases that are opening up everywhere. It's got new advanced weapons of mass destruction. I'm losing my sound system if I take my jacket off. It's awfully warm in here, isn't it? There we are. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You probably can hear my pulse right now. Okay. Wait a minute. The empire, there's a whole new literature that's now coming up. It's okay. There's a whole new literature that's now coming up about the decline of empire. The follies of empire, the twilight of empire, and all that. I think these writers are getting all mixed up. It's the republic that's in decline. They're living in the republic, and they think it's the empire that's having a hard time. Oh, our bridges are falling apart, and this is happening, that's happening. That's not the empire. The empire is not in decline, the republic is. And the way to save the republic and defeat the empire is to really go on the offensive. And that's what I think is hopeful about the occupying, the occupy movement that we've got. I mean, this republic, the public services are going from bad to worse. Fiscal viability is going from bad to worse. Serious crises and breakdowns and all that sort of thing. So what's the alternative? I would say the alternative is socialism. And socialism, and the only reason I argue for socialism, not from some ideological commitment, but I look around and empirically I find that contrary to the view that socialism has been proven in history to be nothing, a failure, and it's been thrown on the ash can of history, there were these two great movements that came along, capitalism and socialism, with their legions, and they clashed, and the socialists are shattered, and now capitalism reigns supreme, proving that it itself is the best system. Well, first of all, capitalism does not exist in the West without socialism pumping in and helping it all the time. Every corporation that comes like too big to fail gets subsidized. Not just the banks, all of them. They get loan guarantees, they get export subsidies, they get equity subsidies, they get outright cash grants and aid. They get research and development subsidies of all kinds. Corporate America gets about $150 to $170 billion a year in direct subsidies. They get bailout subsidies, get bailout money, as you know, with the banks. You start a small business and you go under. You see the federal government going to come and bail you out? Hey, Harry, we're really sorry about your dry cleaning place. Here's a few $100,000 to get you through next year. And, you know, I don't want you to lose your two jobs. You got two workers here. So you hire them back and we'll help you out. No, that isn't going to happen. You're on your own. That's called the free market. But these guys, they themselves... So when you talk about the supremacy of capitalism, you mean a capitalism that is state-supported, a capitalism that rips off the taxpayers one side and down the other. So I think socialism, I want socialism because it works. Healthcare, the socialist systems I've seen in France and Finland, too, and Norway, work so vastly much better than in the U.S. I mean, we could have a jolly old time with stories. There's a wonderful movie about that. Maybe all seen it. If you haven't seen it, go get the DVD. It's Michael Moore's Sicko. It's really good. I've seen it twice. It does say some very good things. Education, that's, I think, socialist education much better. I taught at SUNY, State University of New York, at Stony Brook and Albany, New York, two of the centers. I forget which one. But I remember when we talked about socialism, students would say, what is it? How would it even work? I mean, I wouldn't want to be in socialist I wouldn't want to be in a socialist place or something. I said, well, you're sitting in socialism right now. This university is state-controlled, it's non-profit, it's publicly funded. You pay only $200 a semester to come. Back then, it's probably now up to 5,000, who knows. I said, it's socialist, and the quality of the teaching and the study and the scholarship here is better than it is on most of the private schools that were around. That was true, absolutely so. So that's how it works better. Utilities. I'm for socialism with utilities, public ownership. In the U.S., the communities that have publicly owned utilities, the money earned by the utility goes right back into the public budget. That's that much more funding, that much more funds for the public to use for streetlights or repairs or whatever else. And when you have a private utility, I live in Northern California, we have the biggest, richest private utility in North America, it's called PG&E, and we also have the highest utility rates and costs. And PG&E just showed how private utility worked just recently by admitting finally that they haven't done the repairs that they've been repeatedly warned about, and that the San Bruno explosion of PG&E gas pipe, which destroyed 40 homes, just wiped them out and killed 8 people, that's capitalism in action. That's capitalism under-regulated. They were given $45 million for repairs, and they used that money on a referendum to prevent further public ownership of things. So this is what I think: environmental care, banking. The only state in the union, North Dakota, that has a state bank was the one that didn't have a fiscal crisis. Well, there were one or two others, but North Dakota, again, the public funds went into a bank owned by the state, which the state could use and invest in ways without a third party, without a mafia third party. That's what capitalism is, a mafia. You can't do anything without me getting my cut. You're going to build some houses? I got to get a cut of that. You're going to do this? I got to get a cut. You can't just have employ people, pay them, they pay their taxes on their salaries, you use that tax money for more and the like. And in the areas where socialism doesn't work, in services, for instance, certain services, the socialist countries were atrocious, then you can have some private enterprise. It's okay with me. But anyway, that's my position. I'm a little soft on small business, I've been told on the internet. What we need to do is fight back. And these Occupy movements have really been a surprise to many of us, and very gratifying. That is, we did not expect this. We thought the left was evaporating and disappearing, and here it's coming out in activist form in great numbers. And the occupation actions are demonstrations, and demonstrations are important. They highlight issues that have long been buried. They mobilize numbers. They give a show of strength behind an opinion. They give the opinion visibility. You see, one thing that the major media do is they don't only control your opinions, and sometimes they don't do that. Obviously, a lot of you would not be here if your opinions have been controlled in the way they want to control them. But they do control opinion visibility, that what we say and what we think about these things gets no visibility. So that, therefore, they prefigure and pre-construct the agenda, you see, of what becomes an issue and what doesn't. And so when we have these Occupy here and Occupy there, it's kind of amazing what happens, that suddenly the media act the way the media will always act. Stage one, the first form of oppression is simply omission. You just ignore and you don't report it. NPR, National Public Radio in the U.S., went 15 days with this huge crowd in front of Wall Street without mentioning it, never mentioned its existence. This is the same NPR that jumped every time the Tea Party had 100 people walk down the street. There'd be 200 media people coming after them, clicking and saying, oh, the Tea Party, oh, they're having an impact on American politics. Oh, they're becoming a real political force. Oh, they may be taking over the Republican Party. A good riddance, have it, take it, choke on it. But here you had this Occupy Wall Street, and they didn't know where it was. They couldn't find the address. And that, so then eventually, then they finally were obliged to notice it. And what did they do? The second stage of media distortion is trivialization. And who do they, whose pictures do they take? They take the clown picture, they take the kids with the war paint and the bongo drums. And I think some of the occupiers are saying, could you leave the drums home one day? You know, just, you know. There was one young man with his picture, I saw it on the internet. He had a nice sports jacket on, he was a clean cut kid, Anglo-Protestant face, sort of, you know, and a tie, and he had a sign that said, "Been out here 2 weeks, no media interview. What is it? I look too normal?" You know, and that's it. You know, you didn't look kooky enough or whatever. So they're trying to do all that, but the message is getting through. And what is impressive are the signs. The signs are about socialism and capitalism and income gap and poverty and wealth and 1% versus 99%. That's a brilliant ploy, by the way, that 1% versus 99%. It says it all in a way. In fact, it's not even 1%. It's about 0.001%. It's about 250,000 people at most, who are of that very astronomical super rich. If you were to draw a sign of, oh, here it is, right here. okay, I worked it in. Miguel said, you gotta work in everything that's on the blackboard, I just did it. So demonstrations should evolve into other forms of action. And that's exactly what happened yesterday in Oakland. You saw that. They called for a national, a general strike in Oakland. So they didn't get that, but they closed down the Oakland port. The Oakland port in San Francisco Bay is a big port, and they closed it down the whole day. That is a message. These ruling interests hear that. They get very nervous. They know that they're sitting on our shoulders. They know it better than we seem to know it, you know? And they are concerned. Don't for a minute think that these political economic rulers don't care what you think. That's the only thing about you that they care. They don't care if you're healthy or sick. They don't care if you got enough food to eat. They don't care if your kids are dying, but they do care what you think and what your opinions are. They get up every day and they look at the polls. They get up every day and they say, what are the three things we hit today? That's all they do. They socialize on you. And they know that when the base of the pyramid begins to shake, the apex feels very wobbly. They have maybe even an exaggerated notion of what the threat is that they live under. But we must move from demonstration to actions, civil disobedience. I'm hoping for greater refusal to serve in the armed forces. For a while, that was showing to be a real Achilles heel in the empire. They were having a hard time meeting their recruitment quotas in the US. That explains Obama's love of drones. He loves those. Those drones are that's the dream, to have troopless, casualty-free, a mechanized war. You can just go out and kill people with impunity and you don't suffer any casualties of your own. And that's political. That's political. They don't care about you killing. They'll take five of your sons and kill them over there. What they don't like is that you get upset then and other people in the community get upset and this becomes politically wrong. It's not that they want to preserve American lives. It's for political reasons. They don't want American casualties and they want to be able to win this with impunity. We need new electoral strategies. Unfortunately, more recently, the recession, the economy has gotten so bad in the States that their recruitment quotas are being met now again. But you know, there was a point during the Vietnam War where the US Army was beginning to balk. There were platoon units that would go out and refuse to make contact with the enemy. They'd go down the road, sit down, and they would fight the war that way, you know? And then, how'd you know what I was doing? And the 101st, the 101st Airborne Division, they had paratroopers guarding the gates at Arlington, you know, when the protesters, I remember that day, and who was at the head of the protest and was standing right there with them, facing them, Vietnam veterans against the war, guys who've been to Vietnam. And the 101st U.S. paratroopers, elite, this is an elite corps, they refused to arrest any of them. They said, we will not arrest veterans of the U.S. Army and military forces. And that's when the guys up at the top get very worried when their security forces are not giving them security. So much of this struggle, none of it is about guns. Everything about it is about ideas and the battle for people's minds. And so we have to really wage ideological education and the like, build unions, build actions that improve things, but also show people where and how and why things are the way they are. And most of all, not think like the liberals. See, the liberals see all these things in the world and they get some rough picture of it all, and then they don't know how to put it together. Or if they were to put it all together, they would come out with not a liberal complaint about stupidity and ineptness, they would come out with a radical analysis. So instead of doing that, they say, it's stupid, what a mess, and oh, isn't it confused? And our job is to move from a liberal complaint to a radical analysis, to an ideology that becomes a weapon and a liberation, and that is one of the deepest kinds of revolution we can hope for. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Oh, we can do Q&A. You want to do Q&A? How about just a few questions, because the pay isn't that good. That's not the reason. That was just for Joe.
Before we start, we have the sign-up sheet for Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, one of the sponsoring organizations going around. So if you want more info about events like this coming up, there is something that we're thinking of about Syria and Iran for January, so make sure to sign up for the mailing list. So questions for Dr. Parenti, please keep it within 1 minute, be concise and succinct.
I'd also like to see some women raise their hands. There's always guys.
All right, so we'll go here and there. You go ahead.
I'll call one. Sit down.
Thank you. Let me take care of myself.
Okay, my name is Walter, and I've read a book which talks a lot about revolution or protest, and I read a book by Gandhi. And that was quite fascinating, the way they managed to flesh out, let's say, the control of the British over India back.
Can everybody hear him? People back in the cheap seats, can you hear him? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Can you hear him okay?
Okay.
So I'm wondering, what do you think of the kind of approach of Gandhi? I don't know if you read his book or not, but I thought it was done in a peaceful way of nonviolence, and that's what he preached about, nonviolence, but to create a means of revolution and demonstration in a way that will affect changes. And I think that was quite a thing. I wonder if that type of system would work with what is now transpiring between this year recent events of demonstration against, let's say, the offset of rich and poor.
Well, in this, so far this last couple of weeks, we haven't had, there's been some civil disobedience in some of those cases where the police were arresting people. They were, quote, justified. They said clear the streets and they refused to clear. So there were acts of civil disobedience. They were filling the jails. To get into Gandhi, it's a complex thing. Some people say he was doctrinaire in this. Others say he was not. Apparently, he made links with Indian guerrillas. There were Indian guerrillas who had been blowing up bridges and fighting the British in just the other way. And there are those who argued that he was for civil disobedience in certain situations, given certain conditions. But I heard that Gandhi recommended to Jews that they should perpetrate or they should attend civil disobedience in Nazi Germany. Well, I'm sorry, that's a different situation, and civil disobedience wouldn't have done very much to help their fate. So India has never had a revolution, and that's really a problem of its poverty, and that's the difference between India and China. China had a communist revolution that destroyed the feudal class. In India, 70 to 80% of the people are still living in feudalism and immense poverty. Mm-hmm.
Wasn't India communist at one point?
No.
No,
no. Gandhi was, I don't think, I have no news that he was ever a communist.
Well, Gandhi wasn't the only